Support for IPR comes from Mearden, Supel & Downer, attorneys at law, dedicated to providing comprehensive legal solutions for Eastern Iowa since 1948. Located in downtown Iowa City and at MeardenLaw.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we will find out about Time and Traditions, the archaeology of Northwest Iowa. It's a new permanent exhibit at the Sanford Museum and Planetarium in Cherokee. But first, Shishwen Collins of Bettendorf has been through some major transitions in her life, immigrating to the United States from her native China, becoming a biology professor, and now a novelist. She began writing in English in 2015 and published her debut novel, Flowing Water, Falling Flowers, just over a year ago. The novel spans five generations and two continents. In the modern storyline, Rose Ming is a Chinese-American college professor who loses her job and the man she considers to be the love of her life in one fell swoop. Faced with a great deal of free time as she figures out what to do, she travels to China with her mother. And when she arrives, she realizes that she, her mother, her aunt, and her cousin have all shared a strange dream that inspires them to search for an ancestor that no one seems to remember. And Shishwen Collins is on the line with me now. Hello, Shishwen.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, and it's wonderful to hear your voice. People who listen regularly will know that we tried to do this show last week and had some technical problems, so it's wonderful to hear you loud and clear. And let's get started with a little bit of your personal history. Can you tell me about where you grew up?
Okay, I was born in Hechuan in Sichuan province in China, and I grew up in a place called Kanding, which is very close to Tibet and East Tibet Plateau.
What made you want to come to the United States to study?
I've had a master's degree in China, and then I decided I wanted to go for a PhD, and I said I could stay home, do a program, but if I wanted to do advanced study, I could also try to find a place that's far. So I applied for a couple of schools here in the U.S., and I came to Iowa State University because they gave me full scholarship. So I always tell people that I went where the money was.
And when you had applied to Iowa State University, did you know where that was?
I kind of know because I had a friend who came here a couple of years before me. And unfortunately, one of the things I know about Iowa was that shooting by the physics PhD student of Iowa. So people were saying, oh, are you going to that school? And I said, no, I understood that there were three land grant or state universities in Iowa, and I'm going to the one in Ames.
So when you were pursuing your PhD, you're studying science. Tell me about that career path and how you decided that that was the direction you wanted to go with your life.
Yeah, so it's really interesting that I always wanted to write. I just love books. I like to read. I guess my parents think it's really difficult to have a career in writing, probably. So in China, in high school, we were divided into two tracks. Once you are in, I think, second year in high school, one track is humanity. So you would take humanity courses and you would end up on the humanity track. And the other track is on the science track. So my parents said, well, you need to do science because it's just better job and opportunity. And it's also safe because chemistry is the same no matter where you go, right? Like which country you go, who's
a universal language, right?
Yeah. So I got on the science track and that's pretty much where I went. You know, just like following my parents' direction and doing what they asked me to do. That's how I ended up in science track. But I guess I've always wanted to write. And in China, I wrote poetry. I had poetry published in Chinese, but not really seriously considered about writing until just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it just didn't feel like something that you could actually do professionally, right?
Yeah, no. And also just with the limited time you have, you know, like no matter what I do, I want to do it okay. And just there's just no time to really learn the craft and and learn how to do it. And I kind of also feel guilty about doing this, and I hope if anyone from Ames, my professors, hear this, and I'm sorry that I am not continue on the science track. And when I was in college in, as an undergrad, and one of the biochemistry teacher had said, if you want to write a novel, maybe it's you shouldn't be in this class, you know, so go write your novel because you're not going to be able to write your novel if you're here. So that somehow stuck to me, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do science, and I'm going to try to do it good, and there's no time to write a novel.
So it sounds like there's just been a lot of pressure on you to really turn away from this other side of you as a writer and a person who loves literature.
Yes, 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 absolutely. Yeah, I just feel a lot of obligations, and I really need to fulfill.
So how did this happen? I mean, what was it that made you think, I can't turn away from this side of me?
So you mentioned I started writing in 2015. I remember I was waiting for my son for his summer camp, and I was sitting there in the weight room, and I started type something on my laptop, and then I had a short story. So I showed that short story to two friends, and both told me, oh, it's not so bad, and didn't put me to sleep. So I said, oh, okay, I guess that's a pretty good compliment. And then in 2016, at the beginning in February, there's a local contest. It's called Iron Pen Contest. It was organized by the Midwest Writing Center here locally, and it's a 24-hour writing contest. And so they'll give you a prompt at 5 o'clock on Friday, and then you have to turn in your work, whether it's a essay or a poem or a short story, by 5 o'clock on Saturday. So I saw this ad on the newspaper, and you pay $10 to get in. I said, okay, it's not too expensive, and I'm going to force myself to write something. So I wrote something and actually placed the third in this contest.
Wow.
In short story. But I always tell people it's beginner's luck because I never want anything again after that, right? But anyway, I won this third place, so I showed up and the reading, and I didn't know anybody. And I said, I was just so lucky finding this Midwest Writing Center, which is a nonprofit organization, and they have lots of workshops. And I got encouragement from everyone there. You know, I was very worried about my English. It's not my first language. And, you know, all these other people, I feel like they're real writers, and I'm just pretending. It's only my second short story. But everybody was so encouraging, and I started taking workshops, and I really get into that. And I said, you know what, this is something I really always wanted to do, and I have so much joy when I have the time to do it, and I should just try to keep up. So I'm just trying to keep up evenings, and I don't watch TV. After I'm done with my work, grading, preparation, my lecture, I just write. On the weekends, I wrote during summer breaks and winter breaks, and I wrote. And that's how I just keep at it.
Tell me a little bit about what it's like to write in English, because, of course, I imagine that when you fell in love with literature, you fell in love with Chinese literature and maybe literature from around the world that have been translated into Chinese. Tell me a little bit about your relationship to reading and writing in English.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I feel like I read a lot, but sometimes I can't really talk to people about, you know, British literature or literature, Russia, you know, novels, because I read them in Chinese. Writing English, I guess because I'm seriously writing, when I started practicing writing, it was in English. And I've been here for really a long time, and people have told me, like, if you start dreaming English or in the language, then you kind of, like, having some understanding of the language, and you don't have to translate it in your head. And that's make me feel like, oh, I think I will write in English. And I really did feel in love with the language. I mean, I still really love Chinese books, and I take any opportunity to read them. But I really fell in love with the language, English. And I feel like it can say what I want to say in a really nice way that I haven't actually trying to write a short story in Chinese. Like, I've never written a short story or any fiction in Chinese. I wrote a couple of poems. That was it. So, mm-hmm. It's really interesting, but I do have a struggle. Like, one of the things I tell people is the tenses, right? Because in Chinese language, we don't have tenses. We just use, like, some kind of word to describe it in the past or future or currently. So my tenses are all over the places, you know, when I'm writing. And so my friends were like, well, you're switching tenses here. I'm like, I know. I'm, like, really trying to work hard on that. And then there are also phrases like or something I feel like I really can't translate to English. So one of the main character in the book is called the Gan daughter, which, you know, I talked to my editor, like, should I use Gan daughter? Is it a goddaughter? But it doesn't have that religion's guidance kind of meaning to it. But it's not adopted because it's not really adoption. Because if you're adopted, you're really just a daughter, right? So I decided to keep the word Gan daughter in there when I wrote the book. So there's this definitely something really interesting, the challenges I had to go through. And I do feel like very insecure about writing English because it's not my first language. Mm-hmm. And I would just like constantly worry about, like, am I good enough of my writing?
Well, I don't think anybody who reads your novel would necessarily think that English wasn't your first language. So you certainly achieved that in your writing. And we only have about a minute before we go to a break here, Shishwen. But you and I spoke not very long ago because you were a guest on the Talk of Iowa Book Club, and we were talking about The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. And I know that Amy Tan is an author that's very important to you. Can you tell me about some of the other authors that have really influenced you? And we can get started and pick up after the break. So in about 30 seconds.
Okay. In addition to Amy Tan, Lisa C is another writer that really influenced me. Her historical novels that sit in China and South Korea. Recently, I've been reading Min Jing Lee, another Asian American writer. And I also really love Sue Monk Kidd, the feminism in her work. And I really love that. Toni Morrison, Louise Erdrich, these are some of the writers that I really love. Recently, I've been reading a lot of Asian American writers, Alexander Chi, Charles Yu, C. Pam Zhang, R.O. Kong, and Yi Ying Li.
Wow.
These are the writers that I really love.
All right, Shishwen, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Shishwen Collins of Bettendorf. Her debut novel is called Flowing Water, Falling Flowers, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Security Abstract Company, providing trusted, comprehensive abstract and title services to the Johnson County real estate market since 1898, located in downtown Iowa City and at securityabstractcompany.com. Support for IPR comes from The Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about The Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, we'll find out about a new exhibition at the Sanford Museum and Planetarium in Cherokee. It's called Time and Traditions, the Archaeology of Northwest Iowa. With me right now is Shishwen Collins of Bettendorf. She's the author of Flowing Water, Falling Flowers. And we've been talking about some of the major career transitions she has gone through. She grew up in China about 25 years ago. She came to the United States to get her PhD. She's been a biology professor. And now she is writing full time. And just before the break, we were talking, Shishwen, about some of the many authors that have influenced you. And it sounds to me like you do a lot of reading. Has that been a really important thing in this evolution for you, is just to make sure that you're reading as much great literature as you can?
Oh, absolutely. That's what I wanted to tell anyone who wants to write, and you must read. I mean, I'm not very picky what I'm reading. I'm gravitated towards literature a lot, but I read, you know, romance and cozy mystery. I have friends who write sci-fi. I would read anything I can get my hands on, basically. So yeah, reading lots of books.
So let's talk about your novel, Flowing Water, Falling Flowers. What was the inspiration for this novel?
So I've always wanted to write a novel based in Hechuan, which is my birthplace and my mother's hometown. And I grew up hearing stories. Some of them seemed so far-fetched. Like in one story, my mom says one of her aunt had a dream on the day when they went to sweep the tomb, and she woke up and speaking in a different voice, and she was talking about the ancestor, and then they all had forgotten, and they need to go find her. So that kind of inspired the dream in the book story. So I kind of know what I wanted this story to be. I know, you know, you call what ifs of the story. And then I took a novel writing workshop taught by another Iowa writer, Callie White Van Bally, and again, through the Writing Center. And then the class was about how do you revise your novel, but I didn't have any novel at that point, so I was kind of cheating because she was talking about how important that page 50 is in your novel. So she gave some writing assignments, and so I wrote a couple of chapters to start with, and then I wrote another couple of chapters. So that's how it all started.
So inspired a little bit by some of the stories that you heard when you were growing up, and I'll recap the plot a little bit. Again, it's a story that spans five generations in one family, but we really start with Rose Ming, who lives in the United States, has grown up in the United States, and she's a Chinese American college professor. She loses her job, she loses the love of her life, and then she travels to China with her mother. And she seems very familiar with both the language and the culture. So this is something that's been culturally important to her. But maybe you could read for us just a little passage from something that happened on the flight. We mentioned that dream when she is flying to China. She has a weird dream on the plane. And if you could read from the moment when her mother wakes her up.
Okay. Rose, Rose, someone was shaking me and removing my mask and headphones. Wake up, Mei Mei. The rumbling sound of the engine flooded my ears and the cabin lights went on, blinding me. My mother was the one waking me up, and she looked worried. A couple of people stared at us. They quickly turned their heads when they saw me staring back. I wiped the sweat from my forehead and caught my breath. I had a nightmare. I saw Grandma Pearl, and she told me to look for her grandmother. My mom fixed a stunned gaze on me before she said anything. The loudspeaker announced that all passengers needed to have their seat belts fastened, the chairs in the upright position, and the tray tables stowed away. We were about to land in Chengdu. Good, no more weird dreams, I thought. Then I heard my mom. Rose, now you too hand the dream, she said, putting up her chair.
That's Shishwen Collins reading from Flowing Water, Falling Flowers. And Rose discovers that not just her mother had the dream, but so did her aunt, so did her cousin. All of the women in her family have had this dream. And she decides that she is going to be the one to really unravel this mystery and to find out about this woman that apparently everybody in the family has forgotten. And so in your novel, it doesn't feel like as much of a mystery for us as readers because you take us back in time and we really spend as much time with this first generation in the novel as we do in the modern day.
Yes. Yeah. So at the beginning, I knew that my story happened in the past. So I was trying to decide a timeline. When did it happen? And I definitely want the 1911 revolution, particularly the Sichuan Railway Protection Movement, and have that as the backdrop of the story. So I knew that was the year 1911 where something very significant is going to happen. From there, I try to figure out how old my characters were, and I try to make up a chart to keep track of their ages. And from there, the rest of the story sort of fell in place. I guess I did want a present storyline because people asked me, like, well, you're so brave to write too. And I said, short answer to that, it was I didn't know what I was doing. It's my first book, and I didn't know. It was tricky to get into two storylines. But mainly, I wanted to kind of show what China is like now, especially that part of China, Sichuan province, depicted in the book. it's not like a lot of major Chinese attractions, such as Beijing or Shanghai. You know, when people go to China, they go to those places. It's part of China. It's very rarely got into a book. That's how I feel for American readers. And not many people probably have ever been to that part of the world. I mean, even though people probably know, if you like Sichuan food, then you know it's very spicy and very hot, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I wanted to definitely take a reader on a tour, so to speak. And the second reason is I'm very kind of wanted to have readers to have some kind of connection to the story. Even though there's like universal theme about, you know, love and loss and mother and daughter relationship, how can a regular American reader kind of be connected to that? So I feel if we have something contemporary and if Rose herself is Chinese American, maybe we can establish a kind of connection with the readers. And I also don't want people to think, oh my God, you know, Chinese people are so backwards and they're killing their infant babies, you know. And that was like more than 100 years ago, and it was not like that today. So I that was another reason I feel like I needed to have something contemporary to show how what a change the world China is today.
Well, and that's an important plot point in the novel, is that there is a little girl born into this family, and there's so much pressure to have a son that the mother of this baby is afraid that her daughter will be killed because she's just simply because she is a girl. And that is the thing that happens that sets off this chain of events that takes place over 20 years and then has been lost to this family history. So I'm not going to give away any of those little details, but it does bring up a really important thing. I mean, obviously here in the United States, everywhere around the world, the fight for women's equality has been long and hard and isn't over. And in China, I mean, this is a very clear look at the patriarchy in China, where girls were not only not valued the same way as boys, but in the higher ranking families, the girls also had their feet bound, which really physically bound them and made it so that they wouldn't even have the kinds of physical freedom as men. This seems like a really important piece of history to understanding China.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's part of the status symbol when you have small feet, which means you don't have to do physical labor. And it's really interesting that it's actually the mothers of those families usually force their daughters to have their food bound. Lisa C., I mentioned she's a really important influence on my work. She actually had a novel that described the whole process and how, you know, girls had to go through that. So, yeah. They claim it's to make you more marriageable and make you look really beautiful, but I think you're absolutely right. You know, physically, you're not even capable of taking any walks or anywhere. I mean, what else can you do other than just stay where you are within the bounds of the house?
Yeah. You, and you tell this story through the eyes of women through generations. So even the modern women are looking back on this past. Was that important to you, that we were looking through the eyes of women throughout all five generations?
I think it's really important because we wanted to learn from history. And sometimes, you know, we hear people say history repeats itself, right? Maybe not in the exact the same way, but it's definitely that we need to learn history in order to understand, you know, and also value and cherish what we have today, and then continue that work so then we don't kind of go backwards. And I think this is true in China. It is true in the U.S. also. Like we needed to, I mean, a lot of times then we forget what it was like before. And so we took everything for granted, what we have now. So we needed to understand what used to be in order to know what is good today and in order to keep moving in the right direction.
You mentioned earlier the 1911 revolution, and you have a couple of major historic turning points that play important roles in this novel. For people who aren't familiar with Chinese history, can you tell us just briefly about the 1911 revolution?
So the 1911 revolution is a revolution that ended the dynasties of China. So the Qing dynasty, that was the last dynasty, basically was over after 1911 revolution. And then China went from a dynasty controlled by emperor to a republic. So that was a major, major event in Chinese history. The railway protection movement that happened in Sichuan was considered a very important part of this 1911 revolution. It was actually considered if that railway protection movement did not happen, then the revolution in 1911 may not happen at that particular time moment. Mm. So that was really important. I did a lot of research, and I tried to put some of the information in the book, but my editor said, well, this is all interesting, but when you read a novel, you are not wanting to be kind of weighed down by all these historical facts, and if you really like them and put them in your footnotes. So right. I did have an author's note in the end.
I appreciated that because I knew nothing about the 1911 revolution or anything about what was going on with the railways in China. So you also before we run out of time, though, I want to mention that you also write about the after effects of the Cultural Revolution, which I think more of us are familiar with. It took place in the 1960s. And you write about, you know, the re-education of individual family members as they were making this transition that really was designed to create a communist country, but also purge so much of the past, the traditional elements of these families. And this family lost some significant history because of the Cultural Revolution. Is that something that your family experienced or that you've observed?
This is definitely inspired by my own family's history. And I think my aunt was the one that went to the countryside. So people always ask me, like, how much of this is actually true happening in your family? I'd say most of that is fiction, but the Three River Photo Studio, that's actually my family's business. So that part, like how it became a state private joint venture, and eventually we just completely give up on that. And that was part of the family history. And my aunt actually went to the countryside to get reeducated. And then from what I heard, and sorry, aunt, she was the one that actually did burn our family in genealogy. And and again, I don't want to give out plot. Thanks for reminding me that, Charity. But that inspired the story in the book.
Well, and it inspired me to look a little bit more into Chinese history because it's not something that I know a great deal about. And I was grateful, like I said, for the afterword that helped me put some things in context. Before we run out of time, I know that you call yourself a retired biology professor now. Obviously, you have a great deal of life and energy left. This is not an end of career retirement. So tell me about your future plans. What are you hoping to do?
So right now, I'm just like my two main goals is one is to help my son, help him navigating. You know, he's about to be in junior high next year, and just like be there for him. And then when he's at school, I'm just going to do more writing. So I just finished my second novel, and I'm getting some interest from agents. So I'm trying to get it published. And then I've started writing my third novel, and then two of the main characters actually have quite a bit of Iowa ties because I did a bunch of research, and I find something really, really interesting about women in Iowa around the women's suffrage time period and that connection with China, which is really, really interesting. And I did a lot of reading, and I'm very excited about writing that. So I'm going to do a lot of writing and reading also.
Well, that is extremely exciting. Can you give us a little bit of a hint of what your second novel is about?
So the second novel, I also, again, had three generations of women, and they all have to make choices when they became mother. And some choices that the foremothers made would affect the younger generation in an unexpected way. So again, it's family drama, it's a historical novel, and I have very strong female characters, some of them inspired by real life Chinese women. And I just wanted to show, again, in a patriotic society, women have very limited choices, but they did the best they could, and they try to have their agencies the best they could.
Well, Shixuan, yeah, that sounds fascinating, and I can't wait until it's published and I get an opportunity to read it. But thank you so much for talking with me and sharing your story and really your incredible bravery at taking this leap.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. And thank you for all your support, Charity. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Shixuan Collins is the author of Flowing Water, Falling Flowers. That's her debut novel that was published just over a year ago. And she has been through some major transitions in life, now transitioning from being a biology professor to a novelist. More to come in future years. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about a new exhibition at the Sanford Museum and Planetarium in Cherokee. It's called Time and Traditions, the Archaeology of Northwest Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Sanford Museum and Planetarium in Cherokee, Iowa has a pretty long history, first opening in 1951. But a new permanent exhibit at the museum allows visitors to take a much longer view of history. It's called Time and Traditions, the Archaeology of Northwest Iowa, and it incorporates artifacts, history, and art to make sure that history that it represents tells a full and accurate story of Northwest Iowa. The museum invited archaeologists and indigenous partners to help them craft the exhibit. An open house will be held on Sunday, January 30th from 1 to 3 at the museum. And with me on the line now, Quinn Black, curator of archaeology at the Sanford Museum and Planetarium. Hello, Quinn.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for being here. Also with us today, Lance Foster, an archaeologist and vice chairman of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska. He was part of the advisory committee for the exhibit and painted a mural that will appear in the exhibit. And he's also the author of The Indians of Iowa. Welcome back to the show, Lance.
Oh, thank you, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And Quinn, I'll start with you. I know that you came on board after this exhibit had already been conceived, but give us an idea of how it came about and why it was needed.
Yes. So the museum, as you said, founded in 1951. There's been about three renovations to the archaeology exhibit downstairs. The last one was done probably around 2001, I believe. So it's been about 20 years. It was in the need of an update. And yes, my predecessor, Megan Strobe-Meserl, the previous archaeologist at the museum here, she was the one who kind of jump-started that. And we had the master plan that was all completed. So I came into this position with pretty much everything laid out. The consultation had already been complete. But yeah, I pretty much took it over and have been working on that since I started. And it's been about, it's close to 2 years since I've been here. So it's been a lengthy process, but a fun process along the way. And I'm very excited to open this exhibit to the public.
Yeah. Well, and this exhibit is part of a movement that has been taking place in archaeology to really do a better job of incorporating indigenous voices and perspectives, because, of course, archaeology has been sharing indigenous history for a long time and for a long time, not necessarily including indigenous people in telling that history. So was that part of the push to create an exhibit that did a better job really giving us a full picture, Quinn?
Definitely. That was a very major part of this, because Pretty much, we want to engage in a meaningful dialogue with the descendants of communities. And we're trying to incorporate the perspectives from Native American sources, and that's through the consultation process. So we consulted with active tribal historians and archaeologists, gained their value and their input, and we did listening sessions and interviews with these advisors. And pretty much the whole purpose is to better tell the stories they choose to tell. We want definitely to focus on how they want to be represented and give them the autonomy of that. And that was kind of the how this came about.
And Lance, I can't imagine a better person to help with this process than you, as both an archaeologist and an Indigenous man. So tell me a little bit about how you got involved in the project.
Well, I had visited the museum some years back, and I've known Megan for a number of years. She helped us with some geophysical testing here on the reservation down in Kansas, Nebraska. And so it was really good to be part of that. And then when they brought up the possibility that they might need some art for a mural down there, I was glad to help out there. And really the whole point of all of this is that Indian people are not just some fragment of the past, but we're living, breathing people that continue today that are your neighbors.
Was that something that you saw in past exhibitions, or I'm sure many museums, but this exhibit that is being replaced, where it felt like any story of Indigenous people in Northwest Iowa was a story of the deep past, Lance?
Yes. I mean, it was basically a fairly dim, it was pretty good, I thought, in general, the exhibit before, but it certainly needed updating with some of the new discoveries in archaeology, as well as really helping to have people see Native people as the variety that we are. For example, one of the images there, and I want to shout out to Will Thompson of Armadillo Arts, who is one of the primary designers of these exhibits. He took two young people from our tribe, Kyla and Kayla Kent, brother and sister, and he did this interesting kind of portrait that combined Catlin's historical paintings of two Iowas, and then you kind of move in a direction in the museum, and it's almost like those old kind of prismatic effects that you move in a direction and it changes from the historic to the contemporary photo. So that kind of helps that transition really get embedded in people's mind and help them see that we continue today.
Oh, absolutely. And Quinn, I know that you had a connection. You didn't grow up in Iowa. You're originally from Georgia, but you had a strong connection to the archaeology of Northwest Iowa through your thesis. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that you did near Cherokee?
Sure. So, yes, I actually did an internship at the Sanford Museum in 2017, and I decided to do my thesis on the Pilot Rock site. And that's about 3 miles south of Cherokee. It's a very large glacial erratic that was left here from the glaciers. And it has Native American rock carvings on it. So I basically did a survey of identifying all the petroglyphs, which are the rock carvings that are on the surface of the rock, and looked at basically like a landscape analysis to see if any of them were oriented a certain way to the landscape, for instance, the river or other, you know, natural things around the landscape. We also found some projectile points at the site, and that kind of helped with dating the site as well, because not a lot of research had been done to it since like 1934 was the first investigation. So basically, yeah, giving the people of Cherokee more information about the history of the area is what I did with that thesis project.
Wow. And these, the projectile points that you found were pretty special as far as artifacts go, it sounds like.
Yes. One of them was, it was intact. A lot of the times you find broken projectile points. when we're out surveying, but this one was completely intact. And what was very cool with it, it's made of chert, and there was actually tiny little fossils inside of the projectile point that you could definitely see on the surface. And it makes me think maybe that was specially chosen because to highlight those really cool fossils that were part of the material. So that was a complete projectile point we found, and it really helped with dating the site. So we're thinking around maybe 900 AD to 1100 AD. And a lot of the styles of the petroglyphs that are on the rock carved in is part of the hoof print tradition. And that kind of correlates to that same time frame. So we have those two diagnostic objects to go ahead and date the site to about, starting maybe 900 AD to probably 1850. So a wide range of different various people interacting with that site for a long period of time.
Can you tell us about some of the highlights of the exhibit now? I know that you've worked hard to make it an interactive, engaging exhibit for people who visit. Can you tell me about some of the highlights?
Yeah, sure. So when you first enter the exhibit, you're going to be, basically your attention's going to go straight to those lenticular images that Lance was talking about, the split photo illusions. So when you first are looking at it, you're going to see, I'm sorry if I pronounced this incorrectly. I'm going to try my best. Nohan Munya is Iowa chief. So he was painted by Catlin in the 1840s. So you'll see him. And then when you walk past it, it's going to shift to Kyle Kent, what Lance was talking about. And so then you're going to walk through and you have this really great display of artifacts through the different timelines. So we go through the Paleo-Indian period in Iowa, which is, around 12,000 years ago. There's some there's a Clovis point on display, and then various other pieces like pottery as well. And we have some replica pipestone tablets that are on display as well. But the most interactive things we have is there is tools that are on display, like tools of the trade for archaeologists. So we have a trowel on display that people can touch if they want. We have a dust broom for when you're working in an excavation unit. There's a touch screen kind of interactive geophysical thing for kids to touch, and it shows you basically with geophysical surveys what different items are highlighted on a map. You can touch and see, for instance, if there's a fire hearth that was identified, you can touch that button and it highlights it. There's a pottery puzzle for kids to put together as well. We have a trash can that has materials in it that are stacked from, let's say, Monday to Sunday. And you can see it through time. That kind of shows us how we do in archaeology, stratigraphic layers. So the stuff from Monday is going to be older than the stuff from, let's say, this coming Saturday. So that's really interactive.
So you're giving, it sounds like we're giving visitors not just some history lessons, but also maybe inspiring some future archaeologists as well. And Lance, I would love to hear about your favorite things about the exhibit, too.
Well, dang it, I haven't been able to get there yet.
Oh, you haven't been there yet. All right. Well, yes, it's been a really difficult time to travel. I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. I do want to, before we talk about your artwork, Lance, and I want to make sure we have time to do that. Quinn, I know that there has been a real focus on just showing people how bison were used by indigenous people. And that is a really important part of the exhibit, too, right?
Yes, for sure. Yes.
And why do you think that's so important?
Pretty much, yeah, there was, during this period, there was a near extinction of the bison, and because it was overhunted, and it was like a desolation of food sources. And the bison was, very vital. It provided food, and on top of just food, tools, because you can make needles out of the bones of a bison for, your sewing activities. And sinew, which is, part of the tendons of a bison, can even be used for strings and threads. So all aspects of the bison were used. And we have this huge graphic panel where people can actually go up and touch certain items. We have artificial sinew that they can touch and feel what it is. We have a bison hide drum that kind of shows what you can make from a bison hide. You can make a drum out of it. We have even a bison tail from an actual bison we have that people can touch as well. And there's tools that are on display behind glass on the bison graphic.
Oh, nice. And Lance, let's talk about your artwork because, again, you were invited to create a mural for this exhibit. And I've been following you on Facebook and really watching a lot of your evolution as an artist, at least in the last couple of years. And this painting that you have created is so beautiful. Can you describe it for us?
Sure. It is a young woman or a young girl, back to the viewer. And she's doing what they call a jingle dress dance. And basically it started sometime over 100 years ago. Some say it might have been around the flu pandemic of 1918. Girl was really sick. Her grandfather, who was a medicine man, had a vision about how to heal her, that she should get up and dance. So the little cones on her dress are like the ice from that time period. And she is from the wintertime. And so she is dancing away the sickness. And that was the whole design there, because we were in the middle of the pandemic. And so you can see some of the viruses, but also the illness of the earth itself. And the pollution, the industrial waste that are making the land sick. So as she dances, she's dancing that away with her feather fan, her eagle feather fan, looking up at the sun and the four directions and creating new life. But then also underneath her is the water, the blood of the land. And as they say, water is life, kind of feeding her. So the sun and the water, the clean water, is driving away illness out of the land. That's kind of a description of it.
And the colors are so vibrant, and it makes you feel joyful to look at it. And I've only seen a photo of your original concept. Can you tell me how big the mural is?
I think that there's, if I remember, it's like 5 foot by 8 foot tall, but maybe Quinn can help me with it. Is that right?
I believe that's right. Yeah, that's about right.
All right. So that must just be, I mean, it's big and beautiful and bright and bold, and maybe hopefully gives us all a little bit of hope. And Lance, you mentioned earlier that it's important to understand and make sure that modern Indigenous people are represented in an exhibit like this, because far too many people in the United States think that Native people are a part of the past. So leaving us with just about a minute left, what do you hope to see, not just in this exhibit, but in other exhibits in the future that share this part of our history?
I think it's important to talk about deep time and that two-eyed seeing, the science that's represented by archaeology and the oral traditions about where we came from our own histories, our own understanding of our connection to the land. So I hope more and more museums do that and see that this is not an end of time story, that Indian people are still here. It'd be like saying that because non-Indians don't, you know, ride in covered wagons and wear George Washington wigs, that they're not really they're not really American.
Right, we're extinct, right?
Exactly.
Well, Lance, I hope that you get a chance to travel safely and healthily to Cherokee in the near future. I hope that I get to as well. But thank you so much for talking with me.
And thank you. When are we next?
Lance Foster is an archaeologist and vice chairman of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska. He was part of the advisory committee for this exhibit and also created a painting that is now a mural and part of the exhibit. And Quinn Black, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Quinn Black is curator of archaeology at the Sanford Museum and Planetarium. The exhibit is Time and Traditions, the Archaeology of Northwest Iowa, and there will be an open house for the exhibit held on Sunday, January 30th from 1 to 3 at the museum. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.